So welcome back. Our next speaker is Elise Kroll, who is a professor in the philosophy department at the City College of New York. She received her PhD in the history and philosophy of science from the University of Notre Dame, a great place, not that I'm biased. She's written articles on many topics, including on Einstein, on Poincaré, on Bohr, on Heisenberg, and the lost manuscript of Greta Hermann, which if you're not familiar with, you should take a look at that. Today she's going to be speaking to us on the topic of Heisenberg and the incomplete ability of quantum mechanics. Please join me in welcoming Professor Kroll.
Thank you. So I want to start by thanking Elisa, my academic sister, for inviting me here. It feels like a little bit of a family thing because even though I didn't have the chance to meet Abner Shimoni, I was very delighted to find out that today's forum was named after him because I'm his granddaughter from two sides. My doctor father was Don Howard, who is a student of Abner's. And some of this work comes out of a couple books I'm writing with Guido Bacciagalupi. And Guido was pursuing graduate work in mathematics until he met Abner. And Abner said, you should do philosophy of quantum mechanics. And so through both those directions, I claim Abner as my hero. So anyway, without further ado, let's do some Heisenberg. So the synopsis is really pretty straightforward today. I want to talk about a contemporary view of modal interpretations in quantum mechanics, just sort of a very bare bones explanation. I'll give you a very brief sketch of how Heisenberg comes into the story of modal interpretations, because he does. But I'm going to, the bulk of the talk will be arguing that Heisenberg's role in modal interpretations, or maybe a proto-modal interpretation, should be expanded and considered in light of some of his pre-war writings and things. So my thesis there is that a richer, more nuanced history of Heisenberg's thought reveals to greater degree and in more plausible manner the sense in which he anticipates modal interpretations. All right, so then as Thieks' excellent Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy entry on modal interpretations sketches pretty straightforwardly some of the basic criteria for a modal interpretation. But we go back to von Frassen, who proposed that the quantum state ought to be understood in two different ways, as a dynamical state, which is the usual psi funk, like the vector in Hilbert space, and it describes possibilia, if you will. And then we have the value state, which is the actual or actualized state assigning sharp values to observables. Now, of course, because of the Cohen-Specker theorem in 67, I believe it was, we know that we are unable, without violating the functional relationship between commuting observables, we cannot assign sharp values to all the observables. So there's a limited domain, and so we need, in addition to these states, some sort of privileging function. So if you want to consider Bohmian mechanics, a kind of modal interpretation, then his privileging function would pick out the position observable as the interesting one. So as Deeks writes, importantly, from a philosophical perspective, one should not consider this modality of von Frassen's view as arising from an incompleteness of the description. And so there's something more interesting going on here than just language, maybe, I guess. So the event space on which a probability measure in modal interpretations is defined, or over which it's deployed, is a space of possible events, right? Okay. And only one from this space, or approximately one from this space, is actualized. But what this implies is objective probabilities, and I don't know how far back this distinction between objective and subjective probabilities goes, but it's rather simple. Objective probabilities are just those which belong to the world in some sense, and even God couldn't predict perfectly or something. But subjective probabilities are what a gambler cares about. So when you're dealing with modal interpretations, if you want to give an interesting interpretation, you are going to concede that there is something deeply indeterministic about the world. And how you cash that out may be different, but there is something down there. Now, there's a slight modification that needs to happen. I mean, how do we respond to these objective probabilities? Because we do still carry out measurements, and we do build machines and things like this that rely on quantum processes. So we could bite the bullet. That is, just be happy with the world being objectively probabilistic. And in which case, we might say that the possible state, the possible states, or the realm of the possible, reduces upon interaction of a suitable kind or measurement to the actual. Okay. So if you want to read that strictly on a collapse approach, right, you're going to say that there's actual dynamics that reduce the set of possible states to that of the actual state. But you need not go so far as that. But you are understanding the probability is built into the fundamental nature of the world. Okay? Note well that you don't need an observer on this view. Sometimes that's assumed, but really all you need is interactions that can sufficiently act as measurements. Okay. The other option in sort of responding to the objective probabilities is just to invoke propensities, which metaphysicians really like this term. So instead of saying that the world is deeply indeterministic, you say what's indeterministic is propensities. They're what's ontologically primal, in a sense. So when our reducing of possible to actual upon measurement, it's not a deep or dynamical or something or other. It's just, it's reflecting our ignorance of the actual propensities, as it were. Okay. The last little bit about modal interpretation groundwork is just these particular four characteristics that Deeks lists. It says, look, most of this is the state of play. Most proposals that are meant to be modal interpretations of quantum mechanics, they share these properties, okay? There is no projection postulate, Pache von Neumann. There's no collapse of the psi. Or if there is, it's a heuristic or something like that, right? There is no physical collapse. It's realist in the sense, the specific sense, that it assumes quantum systems possess some, all, definite properties at all times. So not definite values, but definite properties. But I think there's some conflation on those grounds. There's an assumption that quantum mechanics is fundamental, i.e. that all explanations, all processes can be given a quantum mechanical explanation. They needn't, but they can. And then finally, the dynamical state, whether it's pure or mixed, will give possible properties and corresponding values. So that's sort of in place of the eigenstate, eigenvalue link that you use in other interpretations of quantum mechanics, we're going to say that the dynamical state is what encodes this feature of the world. All right, let's do some history. So, from what I could find, most of those who claim Heisenberg has any part at all in pre-modal interpretation history look at post-war Heisenberg. They look at Heisenberg particularly in the 50s and in the early 60s. And I have lots of reasons to be skeptical of Heisenberg's commentary in that era. Some of it is political. A lot of it is because he was more interested in quantum electrodynamics and quantum field theory by then, and whatever he said about quantum mechanics might have been just waxing philosophical or something like that. But also because I think he did a really subtle and nice job of... He was a much more sophisticated philosopher than I think he gets painted most times, especially between 1927 and 1935, which was the area of the history I will focus on here. I think he really has thought it out pretty thoroughly, and so by the time the war happens, he has done with it. But anyway, there are two sources that I'll discuss briefly on the post-war Heisenberg front. So there's Mauricio Suarez, who has this nice paper on quantum propensities, and he's done a bit of work on propensities since then. And so he talks about marginals. I forget what the term marginal uses is, but it's something like potentiality or some synonym thereof. And then also Heisenberg's Aristotelian notion of potentia. And so I'll just quote Heisenberg, as he is in Suarez. So this is Heisenberg in the 50s. The probability function combines objective and subjective elements. It contains statements about possibilities, and these statements are completely objective, contain statements about our knowledge of the system, which of course is subjective. Okay? Another quote, also from Heisenberg's 1958, which I think is physics and philosophy. Yes, physics and philosophy. We may say that the transition from the possible to the actual takes place as soon as the interaction of the object with the measuring device, and thereby with the rest of the world, has come into play. Okay, he's pretty consistent on this aspect, we'll see. But finally, in experiments about atomic events, we have to do with things and facts, with phenomena that are just as real as any phenomena in daily life. But the atoms or the elementary particles themselves are not as real. Maybe he's happy with variable quantifiers or something weird like that. They form a world of potentialities or possibilities rather than a world of things or facts. So this seems... this seems like a different view than what I'm going to point out. Okay, the second source for Heisenberg as a precursor to modal interpretations comes from Christian Kammerler's book on Heisenberg. And he also discusses the closed view of Heisenberg somewhat, but that's in an earlier time period. So he's saying, look, what Heisenberg was concerned with in the post-war era is sort of what he calls a linguistic term. He's interested in semantics, he's interested in a unified sort of language, and he's thinking less about ontology, if it's a fair way to put it. So here are two quotes from, the first is from Christian himself. Heisenberg argues that fundamental theories in physics allow us to know something about the mathematical form or structure of the physical world, though they do not give us direct knowledge of the nature or essence of the entities of physics. So Christian goes on to argue that this makes Heisenberg a structuralist in some sense. I won't deal with that here, but note that it's a considerable backing off from saying that the possibilities are there somehow and they're just not actualized. Okay? The second quote is Heisenberg himself. What is his 19... Physics and Beyond. It should be 1971, I think. Yeah, 1971. If we attempt to penetrate behind this reality into the details of atomic events, the contours of this objectively real world dissolve, not in the mist of a new and yet unclear idea of reality, but into the transparent clarity of a mathematics whose laws govern the possible and not the actual. Right. So, I'll do this later in the talk, but if we were to think about what very limited view I've given you of Heisenberg's 50s, 60s, 70s philosophy, it doesn't really sit well with modal interpretations as they're now understood, at least if we're to take Dietz at his word, which I think we have the right to do. So instead, let's see if we can do a better job by looking at Heisenberg earlier on, and I think we can. So let's look at his pre-war contributions. There's much that can be said about his work in 1927, his correspondence with Einstein, his correspondence with Pauli and Bohr. There's also his conversations at Como, at the Como lecture, and also his Solvay report with Born in the autumn. And of course, his famous Anschaulichkeit paper in 1927 that's about the uncertainty relations. In all of these primary places, I argue we can see hints already of him thinking very carefully about some of the constituents of a modal interpretation. So first of all, Einstein had this very, well, maybe infamous, unpublished hidden variables theory in 1927. Don thinks he didn't publish it. Don Howard thinks he didn't publish it because he realized entanglement. I think that's maybe a little too charitable to Einstein, but he didn't realize that some sort of conservation laws would be violated by his view. But before he, before Heisenberg knew that Einstein had retracted this paper, he wrote him a letter. He said, look, Einstein, you can't publish this thing, and here's why. And he gives a thought experiment that basically amounts to saying, well, look, let's say we pretend we have an electron and it's has the properties of a particle, we send it at a diffraction grating. Fine, okay. If you want to consider the particle as acting locally, you know, i.e. having corpuscular characteristics, then you can't explain the emergence of interference phenomena. But vice versa, if you try to explain interference phenomena, that means you need to incorporate a global aspect of the diffraction grain, not just localized little place where the photon hits it, right, or the electron. And then you no longer have a sufficient explanation in terms of a particle. So interference effects or giving up on the particle picture, you can't have them both. But importantly, in one of the letters, there's two letters that survive from this interchange of Heisenberg's. I think it's the June letter, yeah. He says, indeterminism is necessary, not just consistently possible. So we already have inklings that Heisenberg will consider an objectively probabilistic world, that he sees quantum mechanics as doing the best that it can, but we really are committed to biting the bullet in the Dixian sense, I guess. So a few months later at Como, he says, I don't know if it's right after Bohr's Como lecture, but anyway. He says, for a new observation, the wave packet gives the probability of finding the electron at a determined position. The new observation itself, however, reduces the packet to its original magnitude delta Q. Not a determinate point, no. Which makes a selection from a totality of possibilities and thereby reduces the possibilities for the future. Does not collapse to one, but reduces the possibilities. This continual change of the wave picture at an observation appears to me a fundamental feature of quantum mechanics. One must just put into practice the conception of probability waves. Okay? Right, I won't comment on it. I'll just let that stew. Okay. Solvay report. Guido's written a whole paper about the statistical interpretation that Born and Heisenberg put forward in their Solvay report. But I want to note, in particular, something we said in our 2009 paper about Heisenberg on hidden variables, is that when Born and Heisenberg are talking about usual transition probabilities in their report, it seems to bear a striking resemblance to the notion of potentialities or propensities as they're now used in MI discussions. Maybe it's a bit ill-fated for us to cite Popper there because Popper was notoriously wrong about his modal interpretation. But nonetheless, it seems like they're caught on to some notion here that's similar to propensities or potentialities. Indeed, Born and Heisenberg's transition probabilities are well-defined even when there's no value that could make the transition. Okay, so there's some reality attached to the transition probabilities that is not, nevertheless, not assigned to specific values that those probabilities could take. Outcomes, as it were. Okay, maybe some of you know that Heisenberg wrote a response to the Einstein-Podolsky paper. Maybe you don't. But this was how I actually got started collaborating with Guido in the first place. As a grad student, I translated from German to English this paper for the first time. And I think it's on the Pitt archives still, so you can have a look at it. It's a really fascinating paper. So Paolo writes to Heisenberg in early July, says, hey, Einstein's at it again. Are you gonna do something about it? I think you should write something about the cut, your cut argument. And Heisenberg says, sure, I'll do that. I know Bohr's already writing something, and in fact he did. And Heisenberg didn't publish his paper because he let Bohr do his thing. But he said, I nevertheless want to try and sketch out a full reply. So he does that. And there's just so much stuff going on in this paper. There's just so much stuff. And I've given talks before where I focus on the cut argument because it sort of comes to its fullest expression in this 1935 paper. But also, his treatment of hidden variables is really fascinating there. And he has a third section that's all about observation context that prima facie you might think is just him parroting Bohr. But when you read the correspondence, I should say the arguments that Bohr and Heisenberg had in correspondence after this paper was written, you come to see that he's in no way towing the Bohr line. He's definitely setting forth his own interpretation. And in particular, whereas Bohr's reply has been
much has been said, and we, Guido and I, will continue to say more about Bohr's reply to EPR. Heisenberg presents a totally different view. He's not arguing against EPR so much as against the whole category of explanations, hidden variables or causal completeness or anything like that, because he's determined to show that quantum mechanics is incompletable. It is incompletable. So even if it's closed in an axiomatic sense, it can never be completed to, for example, Einstein's satisfaction. Okay. So about midway through the paper, and this is after, so I guess I should just say that very quickly, if you're not terribly familiar with the cut argument, it's a little unclear whether or not the cut is supposed to be the cut between the observer and the observed, or the microscopic and the macroscopic, or the system and the apparatus. It could cut many different ways, okay? Heisenberg is a little unclear about it himself. But there are two clear points that he tries to make with the cut argument to demonstrate. The first is that the position of the cut is arbitrary, in a sense, okay? So in the sense that if you're talking about the cut between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics, one can always push the cut farther out and farther out and always have a quantum mechanical description behind. But it's not quite symmetric, because you can't have a classical description of atomic phenomena, right? So there's a bit of an asymmetry there, but he's a quantum fundamentalist, so that doesn't bug him too much. The point is, you really can put the cut between any number or chain of interactions. Do we have a little marker? If not, we can just use our brains to imagine. Well, it doesn't matter. He just uses, if you have A, that's your atomic system, and then B, and then C, and then D, E, added, you know, as far as you want. A is just the system to be measured, but B and C and D can be measuring devices of any sort. They can be microscopic measuring devices, like a photon or something, or they can be macroscopic, it matters not. Okay. So he does the mathematics, not quite right, but like von Neumann had already done this proof in 1932, so it wasn't a big deal. The position of the cut really is moved. You get the same deterministic bits going on both sides. On the classical side, you have obvious determinism. On the quantum mechanical side, without an interaction, just in that nice, cozy little area, you have determinism, the Schrodinger equation. Okay? Because the arbitrary placement of the cut is mathematically shown, and both sides of the cut, no matter where it sits, are deterministic, what must we conclude about this fundamental probabilistic nature of the world? It sits at the place of the cut. The cut, as it were, the jump from one mode of description to another, is entirely responsible for probabilities, for the stochastic interpretation. So, after he's given this argument, he goes to the direct question of hidden variables. And I want to quote him a bit at length, because something very fascinating historically is happening in this paragraph. And I helped you by making it that weird orangey-red color. So, we shall examine the assumption that the physical systems about which quantum mechanics makes statistical assertions are carriers of heretofore unknown physical characteristics, hidden variables, in common parlance, that univocally determine the behavior heretofore known only statistically. Okay, thanks, Heisenberg. For example, let us assume that the nucleus of the radium atom somehow possesses, in addition to properties established through knowledge of its stationary state, still other previously unknown characteristics whose knowledge makes possible an exact prediction of when the nucleus will emit an alpha particle. And we assume specifically this assertion should hold independently of the means of observation that are applied for the confirmation of the emission. It should hold independent of what kind of measuring apparatus or where in the chain the apparatus is employed. Next paragraph, he says, one can at first try letting this last assumption drop and allow that the radioactive emission be also conditioned by characteristics of the means of observation. Now, before getting into his proof here, can anyone sort of guess why I think this is such an exciting historical moment in terms of hidden variables?
Yeah.
This looks like he's making the distinction between contextual versus non-contextual hidden variables, anticipating Bell by some 30 years. Okay? He's saying, okay, sometimes the apparatus itself We can include that in part of the hidden variables. Other times, non-contextually, we'll say that the hidden variables are just sort of determined throughout the system. So here we have, again, for the first time, sort of this notion between what has to be determined to get us a causally complete story and what might not be. And this dynamical sort of understanding he has of the atomic system then being measured by B, then being measured by C, etc., I think is in part why he's able to see this difference between contextuality and non-contextuality, to use slightly anachronistic terms, right, already here in 1930s. And I'm going to argue later that this understanding of hidden variables or of ways to determine what is deeply indeterminable help him along this sort of modal interpretation path. So his argument then, once he makes this interesting distinction, his argument for the against context-independent or non-contextual hidden variables is just to say that when the cut is put between the atomic process and B, our next apparatus or something like that, there exists some sort of freedom, we might read possibility, at B, to choose if we want to measure QA or QB. Fine. Okay? Now, assume that there exist hidden variables and push the cutout beyond B. So now we're going to walk back and we're going to put our photographic plate at C or something like that. But now, as we've made that move back, our quantum mechanical predictions about, say, the conjugate variable PA will require a certain indeterminacy in the value of QA, which contradicts our assumption about hidden variables. Right? So if I want to understand this, maybe from a modal interpretation perspective, I would say what's really going on here is that Heisenberg takes probabilities to be simultaneously well-defined. We know this from Solvay. But then we also know that this argument given here crucially depends on the inability of all values to be well-defined simultaneously. So as I said at the very beginning, this is something Kochan and Specker proved in the 60s. Okay? But already I think Heisenberg understands that we can't, I mean, maybe it's because of the relation with the uncertainty principle or some deep thinking he'd done along those lines. So he understands we can have well-defined transition probabilities. We know fully what's going on there. We can determine those. But we don't have definite values. And that's a crucial component for modal interpretations, I think, if they're going to succeed now. So, I guess I already answered this query, but I can answer it some more if you like. Might Heisenberg understand already the need, this third need for von Fossen's view, or any modal interpretation, that you have to have a privileged set of privileged observables somehow, because of the not being able to well-define edit. Like, there are constraints. There are constraints on what can be well-defined, right? I think, yes, based on his response to EPR, the context observation bit, which I'll read to you now, and see if you agree with me. Feel free not to. He says, the same Anschaulich he was just talking about, the same experiment used in 1927 to write to Einstein, so the electron hitting a diffraction grating and scattering in a particular well-known direction. Okay, so the same Anschaulich, intuitive, roughly translated, process can belong to different observational contexts. So we could observe it as quay particle or quay wave, right? Okay. As opposed to classical physics, in which there is only a single observational context. The experimental results accumulated in quantum mechanics have further shown that the observation of a system in general leads discontinuously from one observational context to another. The causal flow can be followed only within a given observational context. In the discontinuous transition from one observational context to another, in fact, complementary one in the Borean sense, only statistical predictions are possible. So now we have he's equating this place of the cut with a switch to a different observation, a mode of observation. the possibility of different complementary observational contexts unknown to the classical theory is thus responsible for the occurrence of statistical laws. What I can say about this, and maybe my claim will become stronger if I explain that Greta Hermann, who I've done like have another book with Guido about, interacted a lot with Heisenberg, was his student at Leipzig. But she wrote in 1933 an essay that she sent to Dirac and to Heisenberg and to Weisberg and to Bohr at Copenhagen, where it's just called The Indeterminism in Quantum Mechanics. And in it, she basically makes this point already. And we know that Bohr and Heisenberg took this pretty seriously because they told Gustav Heckmann, who was also there in Copenhagen at the time, and a good friend of Greta Hermann's. He wrote a letter to Greta and said, hey, they're all taking your stuff really seriously. They're going to try and put their heads together and come up with a response. They never did, but they did offer her to say, hey, come to Leipzig. Come talk to us about Kant. Come tell us about what's going on. And in early 1935, before EPR even, she wrote like a 90-page essay in Kantian German, which I translated. Whew. Into English, and in there she gives, there's a whole chapter of three chapters, one of them is focused on explaining this notion of observational context in a very sophisticated philosophical way, and it has to do with switching from modes of description, and it is the reason that the world is fundamentally unanschaulich in a sense, and we know that Heisenberg read her on this because he cites her in his 1935, and she wrote a preface and helped her win an award for this essay and was interviewed by the Gestapo because of his acquaintance with her. She was very vocal against the Nazi state. So there's lots of reason to think that it was his interactions with Hermann during these years that led him to a view where it's like, look, once you've fixed, it's a bit like Bohr, right? Once you fix the context of your observation, you've decided whether or not you're going to put a measuring device behind one of the slits in the double slit apparatus. You know, you've already decided whether or not you'll perceive interference phenomena or what. You've already limited the set of available observables to those that are congruent with the context of observation. In a sense, you've pre-decided what will be the relevant observables, the ones that you can causally trace. And in so doing, close off all these other observables from measurement. And I think in this way, maybe he's approaching something like a privileging function, right? And maybe his talk about classical concepts has to do with privileging functions in a way too. He's saying, look, we choose observables that are classical observables because we know how to deal with those. We know to explain macroscopic phenomena in those ways. And so let's just consider the set of classical observables or Hermitian operators or whatever as our privileged set.
When did Pauli come up with the idea that if you try to subdivide a quantum ensemble, it's a different ensemble? Wasn't that earlier than this?
Yeah, that's in a letter in, let's see.
31?
It's in response to Born's adiabatic paper in 26, I think. Yeah, so that's good, yeah. I mean, Pauli has all of the answers, he just never published anything, and he's like, ah, this is nothing, boom, and there's all the answers. So yes, I would suspect that that's also inspiring Heisenberg's considerations at this point. Okay, so we're getting to the conclusionary part. Conclusionary? Word? I try to make up a word in every talk. So I'm saying, in what sense might we say Heisenberg predated himself with respect to or with an eye toward modal interpretations? So if we go back to Dietz's four shared traits, if we're looking at just a post-war Heisenberg, and you'll have to take my word for it a little bit because I didn't give you all of post-war Heisenberg, I just gave you selected quotes from selected authors, but just, you know, trust me. It looks like none of the four are really involved in what he's doing. And so maybe we can say he's the precursor to modal interpretation in the fact that he uses this word, potentia, and that gets us really excited. But if we really look at the details, here they are. He often uses the word collapse, if I can recall, in his discussions after the war and when he's put together what he calls the Copenhagen interpretation, but I hope you all now know, believe is not a real unified anything. Okay, so he talks about collapse a lot after the war. So collapse somehow in his mind is playing a dynamic role. That doesn't seem to accord with proto-MI considerations. Okay, second, realist in that he assumes there are definite properties at all times. Well, maybe this is at best unclear, given the quote where he talks about a world of potentialities and he's sort of waxing metaphysical, right? It seems like he's backed off of a more concrete claim like those he was making in Solvay and other things. Now, this one is also, maybe I'm a little unfair, but he probably, to the end of his days, was pretty convinced that quantum mechanics was a more fundamental theory. But he did have this significant linguistic turn, which sounds like something I want to eat for some reason. but Cavalieri does make a good argument in the latter chapters of his book that Heisenberg no longer really cares about some of the debates he was having with Schrodinger about interpretation in the early 20s and 30s. He's interested now in a very, in this linguistic term, right? He's interested in language and semantics and unification at that level. And he sort of divorces himself from the more dynamical picture of the world, the more nitty-gritty picture of the world that we see in, for instance, his Vienna and Chicago lectures in the early 30s and in the response to EPR. So he sort of backs off and starts doing philosophy of language instead of philosophy of physics. Not that they're not, they can't work together, but it's less to the point of a modal interpretation. Okay. And then also this Aristotelian potentia that Maritio talks about. He says, look, at times when Heisenberg's writing about this potentia, it sounds very much like he's talking about something Bayesian, like measures of rational degrees of belief or something. And that's definitely not what a modal interpreter or interpretationist wants to do, right? I mean, they want to say that the underlying reality is objectively probabilistic. And so, yes, maybe Bayesianism maps onto that somehow, but it certainly isn't just about rational beings. I mean, he doesn't think you need an observer at all in his 1935 arguments. You just need an interaction. Okay. And then finally, I mean, it's a bit anachronistic to ask about a dynamic state as pure or mixed. I mean, they did have that language, but they didn't understand it in quite the same way in the 20s and 30s. But I can say, relatedly to the properties versus probabilities, the having definite values versus probabilities distinction, it looks pretty like he's quite vague on this point in the 50s and 60s writings. He confuses them a lot. And Suarez tries to interpret him more charitably by giving a better definition of modal interpretation that carefully picks out what are the probabilities versus what are property values. Okay. But this slide should be no surprise. Here's how I think the pre-war Heisenberg fares on these four points. And hopefully, I mean, I won't go over all the quotes and things. I hope you were letting them stew. But here's the case. He doesn't use the term collapse at all in any of the writings I could think of in this period. He uses the term reduction in his 1927 paper once, reduction of the wave packet. But notice that reduction is not the same thing as like a GRW type collapse. In fact, in the context of what he's saying in the 1927 paper, it looks like he's saying you significantly lessen, you shrink maybe your Hilbert space or something like that. But it's certainly not you get like a one value out. You don't have a collapse to one value. Okay? So he doesn't use collapse or reduction at all in 1935. Just not part of how he's thinking about it. Which is even more important if you think about that, as in the 2009 paper that Guido and I wrote, we compare his no-go hidden variables argument with Pauli and Schrodinger's at the time. And Pauli and Schrodinger are doing it in terms of decomposition. Like, they're thinking about algebraic responses to hidden variables, which is more of the von Neumann thing. Von Neumannish. But because Heisenberg's thinking again about the dynamics of at each step, at A, at B, at C, like what's happening to the wave packet as we understand it, and he never uses collapse or reduction in that context, I think makes it all the more compelling.
All right. Again, the second point, realist in some deep sense. Yeah, I think Heisenberg is pretty clear that not all properties can have definite values, and I gave some reason for you to think that with me. And then also, there are good arguments that I can't go into here in detail, but maybe in the chapter I'll be writing after this for the book, you can read about it. But in this period, 25 or maybe 27 to 35, he's thinking very, very carefully about terminology, because that's his big war with Schrödinger about matrix mechanics versus wave mechanics. He's talking more about sort of Kantian notions of symbol and Anschauung and language. And he's not being sloppy in any way when he's writing his 1927, and he puts Anschauung in the title of the paper. That is like a huh to Schrödinger, right? It's not in the translation, but the English translation. I think the Zurich and whatever, they title it physical content or something. Yeah, physical content, and it's intuition. So I think you can make a really good case, and this is part of what Christian is doing in his book on Heisenberg too. It's just there's a lot. He's being very careful. And so to label him sort of positivist or operationalist is just a misreading of what he's really doing. And this is my sort of, I guess, meta comment to like my own teachers of this field, who are very convinced and very engaged in debate on who was a realist and who was sort of an instrumentalist and who was a what and who was a whatist. And I'm not so sure those categories are appropriate, especially within Heisenberg's particular trajectory. Quantum fundamentalism, I think this is pretty clear. The cut argument is just explicitly quantumly fundamentalistic. It assumes that everything can be explained quantum mechanically. And then finally, the dynamical state gives possible properties and corresponding probabilities. As I've said before, I think there are seeds of comprehending mixed states in here. Maybe I'm being too charitable, Heisenberg. But when he's talking about observational context, he does seem to understand an in-principle limitedness in the way we set up our measurement apparatus that isn't just epistemic, something about the world. And then his distinction between contextual and non-contextual hidden variables, I think, leads him to, like I said, some anticipation of the role that measuring apparatuses, or what you call your system, changes what you call your dynamics. What observables become observables for you depend on whether your system is defined as just this quantum atomic emission, or if it's also including an environment in a suitable kind. All right, I think, concluding slide. So if we go again back to Deeks, these two possible responses for the modal interpreters based on objective probability in the world, one can bite the bullet, say, okay, what is possible reduces in some way to what is actual, but this doesn't necessarily entail collapse, and it doesn't need an observer, etc. Or we have this propensities language. It's like, no, it's not probabilistic down there, but we really have this mysterious propensities distribution or something like that, and that's what gives rise to our inability to give determinate answers. So I want to say that in as much as serious doubt has been cast on propensity talk, and I didn't even argue this part here, but at least in metaphysics, it's not at all granted that propensities are going to win the day. So given that, and in light of the claim that pre-war Heisenberg seems to take this bites the bullet response to objective probability, I suggest that we consider Heisenberg's proto-modal interpretation to be better earlier. Thank you.